with guest Preston Dennett, just ghost hunter and paranormal researcher and pioneer. The most recent of Preston Dennett's 14 books are Ghosts of Greater Los Angeles, published this summer, and UFOs Over New Mexico, a true history of extraterrestrial encounters in the Land of Enchantment, which book will be released this winter. Hello, everyone. Welcome. This is Patrice Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Preston Dennett is tonight's guest. The show is broadcast live on the International Paranormal Radio Network with its anchor station, UPRN 105.7 FM New Orleans. There are several listening venues which are noted at the UFOParanormalRadio.com webpage. Thanks to Joe Montaldo for making these broadcasts possible. Also, check that A Global Focus show webpage at globalfocus.com for guest bio descriptions and program details. And also this evening, I was having problems just with my computer and being able to hear audio both on a Skype and on Pal Talk. So what I've done is, unfortunately, I've had to leave the network room on Pal Talk, but I'll be right back during our break before the second segment of the show to note all the questions for our guest, Preston Dennett. And I'm sorry for that glitch there. I really appreciate the input from our researchers. It always makes for a particularly interesting show. Now, our guest this evening, we're very fortunate he's here. Preston Dennett has authored 14 books and more than 100 articles on ufology and the paranormal. Preston has appeared as guest speaker on numerous TV and radio programs. He is a Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON, field investigator, a ghost hunter, a paranormal researcher, and pioneer in the field, including lucid dreaming and out-of-body exploration. Preston's research has been presented in the Dallas Morning News, the LA Times, and the LA Daily News. His articles have been published in Nexus, Fate, the MUFON UFO Journal, at Rising, the Paranormal Magazine, the UFO Magazine, The Ufologist, and other publications. Preston's popular books on ufology include, with two examples from the several, UFOs Over New York, A True History of Extraterrestrial Encounters in the Empire State, and UFOs Over Topanga Canyon. Preston's paranormal works cover the full spectrum of the field, with the most recent book, Ghosts of Greater Los Angeles, published this summer. In January, Preston's latest ufology book will be released, UFOs Over New Mexico, A True History of Extraterrestrial Encounters in the Land of Enchantment. Preston, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest. We loved your first interview back in April.
Thank you, Patrice. It's great to be back. Thank you. I love doing your show. It's a great show. So, yeah, I'm excited.
Excellent. And I'm just going to write a note here, too. I want to make sure that our wonderful network owner and the director here can hear me as well at this point. Just writing him a note. Joe, can you hear me? And then I'd love to just go right on now and discuss that very engaging, informative book of yours. Actually, they are all in that category. Here, though, I'm referring to Ghosts of Greater Los Angeles. Preston, in your work, Ghosts of Greater Los Angeles, you've highlighted several important locations in the Los Angeles area, as well as fascinating encounters at these locations. Now, quick question here. Preston, you know the technological improvements in ghost hunting and also the different types of explanations for ghostly phenomena. Is it correct that you think the majority of these accounts entail spirits of the deceased versus poltergeists versus demons versus uncontrolled mediumship?
Right. I think that there are poltergeist cases that do involve uncontrolled mediumship. I do agree that that happens, but I think the majority of hauntings are definitely just us after we passed on. But of course, there's also residual hauntings. So there's something you want to kind of differentiate between the two. An active haunting is a ghost that will actually interact with you, can see you, and turns lights on and off, and moves objects and things like that, whereas the residual haunting is more of an echo, and it's usually a tragedy that replays over and over again, and the spirits don't react to you. So those are the most common types of ghosts, definitely.
thanks. That's interesting information. Also, I note that not only are there the residual hauntings, but in rare cases there can be a time slip event where perhaps people are viewing apparitions or other events occurring at a different time dimension or juncture.
Yeah, that's another explanation that I've heard, and there's definitely a few cases like that. I mean, like, where people can see, for instance, when you see a ghost, you expect to see the person, but people are seeing ghostly carriages, you know, being pulled by horses, and ghostly trees, ghostly landscape. So at that point, you know, how do you explain that? So I think that time perhaps is not always as linear as we like to think it is, and perhaps the veil between the world is not quite as strong as, you know, a lot of people believe it to be. I mean, there's no doubt ghosts are real. The evidence for ghosts stretches back hundreds of, if not thousands of years. And, but like you said, we've been throwing a lot of technology at this whole phenomena. You know, the stuff that some of these shows are coming astounding. The proof for ghosts is out there. It's pretty much just like it is for UFOs and this other paranormal stuff. I think it's a great, great time for this kind of research.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, you make a very good point there as well, Preston, regarding the latest technology as far as ghost hunting. Do you think now it's more or less de rigueur for people who are going to be researching these ghosts to have this type of technology? Let me see here. You have several notes here, such as, particular audio equipment, the EMF readers, meters rather. Those, would you consider those now really critical?
Well, no, not necessarily. I think that you investigate it to the best of your abilities and the best of your budget. And certainly the more money, I mean, it's great that some people have, you know, the backing or the funding rather to put behind this phenomenon. I personally don't have a lot of instruments, but I think one of the best things you can do is go on the site and what I've tried to do is get as close to ghosts as I can. I talk to the people who are experiencing it, I go to their houses, and I try and experience some of the phenomena. And I've been successful in that regard. So I think there are different ways of doing research, and certainly I think there is a big push in the field to get proof. But I think just as important is educating people, because like I said earlier, the proof is actually out there. I mean, we have enough footage, people who would, if they were willing to look at this phenomena objectively, and that's the whole trick, because there's a lot of skeptical people out there who are just not, I guess, ready to look at this, or just not willing, or just feel it doesn't affect their lives, and why should they? Every skeptic has a reason. And that's one of the reasons I actually do write these books, is because I was so skeptical growing up, and I just could not believe this stuff was not being talked about. And so I'm trying to reach the skeptic in a lot of cases, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Well said. And, you know, I found my notes here, and you mentioned such equipment as, quote, electromagnetic detectors, infrared photography, motion sensors, audio recorders, ultra-sensitive thermometers, high-definition photography, end quote. But, you know, Preston, your remarks are very well taken, because with your investigation accounts, you really portray the important emotional and historical aspect for these particular sightings, that factor of when the person sees the apparition or other ghostly manifestation, there is that immediate reaction, both mentally, physically, to that sort of anomalous either presence or just anomalous sighting there. And, you know, Preston, also you mentioned that individuals who are psychic are more likely to experience a haunting event, correct? But you also mentioned that some of these individuals may have mediumship abilities. They aren't aware of those capabilities, and that may be a reason why the spirits are attempting to communicate with them.
That's absolutely true. I've learned from several people they would never call themselves mediums, but honest to God, they've had ghost experiences their entire life. And they follow this really similar pattern. They have this poltergeist that bothers them when they're children, and they're often blamed for stuff that they didn't do, but was, you know, done by this poltergeist. And several of them have said the same thing to me. Whenever they drive by an accident, or if they attend a funeral, or go to a hospital, they have to be very careful because spirits will follow them home. And lo and behold, right after they drive by an accident, they get home and doors are opening and closing by themselves and lights are going on and off, and usually it lasts just a couple of days for, you know, most of them. They've learned how to, you know, turn it off, I guess.
Well, you know, Preston,
yeah.
And please pardon the interruption. You know, Preston, that comment there recalled to me in your book where you were noting the accounts of paranormal activity at Los Angeles hospitals. The hospitals didn't wish to be mentioned by name. Well, the employees, rather, didn't want the hospitals mentioned by name. But you were mentioning that one manager in one of the hospitals directed his staff that if they did note ghostly hauntings or ghostly or paranormal activity regarding a room, just to be careful. For example, after a death, it might be good to stop at a very well-populated a location, such as a grocery store, or just where the public was very much evident, to not bring those people home.
Right. Isn't that interesting? You know,
yes.
That's something you don't really think much about. This lady I interviewed, who, you know, is a nurse and has worked at several hospitals, told me this story. And there was a ghost that was bothering one particular room. It would turn off the telemetry boxes. Now, a telemetry box is what's used to kind of monitor the patient, and suddenly it would go off. And so the nurse would have to come running in and see what's happening to the patient. And the patient would say, and this happened with different patients, that a nurse came in and removed it. And sure enough, it would be up on a shelf. But this nurse, they could not identify this nurse. And finally, they got a good description, and it turned out to be, you know, the way nurses were dressed quite a while back. And a bunch of people, this is what got all these nurses talking. And they went into the back room and they were discussing the various ghost encounters they'd had at the hospital when the manager came in. And he was absolutely understanding. So this is kind of a behind-the-scenes thing that probably goes on in a lot of hospitals. As I said, she worked in another hospital, had a very similar experience, actually, with a haunted labor room. And everyone knew it was haunted, all the people who worked there. And it was funny because she said that when there would be a new employee, that everyone would kind of wait and wait and wait until that employee had an experience there. And then they'd say, yeah, and then they'd start, then they'd share their own experience. So this does go on.
And, you know, what I thought was fascinating, too, in your accounts was that this particular type of activity, anomalous activity, was noted by many of the nurses in a particular section. They would warn their co-workers about these events. And, you know, with the question of, for example, a nurse, a shade or an apparition, actually more than an apparition, I guess, misplacing the telemetry equipment that was placed beside a patient, would that indicate to you, Preston, a malevolent ghost or just a confused ghost?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't think that in this case it was malevolent because certainly it wasn't described as trying to harm the patients, but a confused ghost. And I'm going to say that in most cases that's what ghosts are. They're confused, which, you know, I find still difficult to understand how someone could not really understand that they've passed on. But this seems to be one of the problems with when people die. They don't understand, perhaps, and they continue to think they're alive and do the same activity they have always done, and when in fact they've passed on. And in some cases, you know, they're able to move objects quite effectively, you know, and they'll slam doors, turn on lights, and really have an effect on the environment.
That's very intriguing, too. And, you know, from your book, to me it suggests, or am I correct here in my interpretation, that only a percentage of ghosts really are able to make those manifestations, such as turning on lights or turning on the TV. It would suggest that there's a very large percentage that might be out there but just can't physically interact with their environment?
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. I think it's probably a pretty big deal when a ghost gets noticed, because this is certainly what we've heard of in near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, which I've actually experienced, where you float in front of somebody in a disembodied state, and they can't see you, and you do everything in your power to get them to notice you, and it's futile. They just won't see you. And I've tried over and over again, went out of body to try and move objects, and have never been able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty common in the whole UFO. I mean, I'm sorry, the out of body literature. It's very, very difficult to move objects that way. But it appears that shortly after death, or for a while, even the vital body, kind of, which goes along with the ethereal body and all the soul.
And, yes.
And then because of that, it's able to move objects for a while. But how these ghosts are moving objects, that's really a big mystery, I think. And no one's really answered that satisfactorily in terms of ghost research. Or at least not to an extent that I've heard. But I certainly do wonder how it's done.
Indeed, it's an intriguing concept and information there. Thank you. Now, you know, Preston, one account, or actually there were several accounts, really fascinated me, and that was concerning the Roosevelt Hotel in Los Angeles. Apparently this location is very haunted. Could you give a brief description of some of the events that have been noted there, including the appearance of a Marilyn Monroe image in a mirror now located in the lobby at one time in her room, and also Montgomery Cliff haunting the premises?
Right. It's actually probably one of Hollywood or Los Angeles' most famous haunted spots. And I put that as the first chapter in the book because I actually was able to talk to several people, first who had encounters there. And I've been there myself, and it is a spooky place because you can definitely feel that, I don't know, it's like going back in time a little bit, just walking through those, you can kind of feel it, and I'm not super sensitive to energies, if you know what I mean. I'm not a medium by any means.
Right.
But I could absolutely feel something in that place. And I've talked to some of the hotel staff as well, and they confirm it. They used to hand out little booklets, in fact, describing some of the more famous encounters. And there's, at last count, some 100 ghosts there. And the one lady I talked to, I talked to her personally. She walked into the hotel with her friend because her friend wanted to make a phone call, I believe it was, or go to the restroom, perhaps it was. But at any rate, this lady, Kate was her name, she's looking up towards the big staircase there, and she sees this little, person coming down. It was a woman, kind of but dressed up in that old-fashioned 1940s style with a pink dress on and just looking really sharp. And she's like, wow, look at that person, who really looked out of time, sort of.
Yes.
She looked back looked away and looked back and it was gone. And only later did she realize, that was probably a ghost. So.
Yeah, some of those vignettes are really powerful, including the one of the little girl who had died in the hotel, and I guess someone at the front desk, she called someone at the front desk asking for a parent, and the person at the front desk would have a security guard run down to the lobby telephone to see if they could reach her.
Right, right. There's so many cases. And that was a sad one because I believe there was a drowning involved in that
yes.
case.
Mm-hmm.
So that... For some reason, I think the veil between the worlds, I guess, if you want to call it that,
mm-hmm.
Is kind of thin there. And this you see in all kinds of hotels. There are certain locations that are just haunted after a certain amount of time passes because there's so much human activity there. And the
mm-hmm.
hotels are a perfect example. Another really, this surprised me as well, theaters, where people do plays.
Yes.
There's a lot of haunted theaters, a lot of haunted schools, things like this. A lot of haunted churches and missions, or places where people have spent a lot of time in structures that have been used for various purposes. So I think that, there's a lot of more ghosts around there, out there, actually, than people realize. It's not that uncommon.
Yes, indeed. In fact, mentioning mission here. One of your chapters concerns the ghosts of San Fernando Mission, right in Mission Hills, California, in that area. And they were mentioning individuals seeing a very memorable apparition of someone who would appear to be a cowboy, but in gaucho style, probably one of the earlier Hispanic residents from a few centuries back who were property owners there. And it was a very powerful chapter, I must say.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that I talked to that lady, and she was convinced that absolutely that was Dr. Ghost, and she found out later that other people had seen it. And again, it was the same thing that kind of draw people to ghosts, is they look out of place, mostly
yes.
by the way they're dressed. And this guy, they often look completely solid as well, so it's very confusing for witnesses at times, because I think when people think of a ghost, they think, oh, it's a wispy thing, you know, you can see through it, it's transparent. That's true in a lot of cases, absolutely, but it's not always true. And in fact, mediums, this is can be a real problem for them, because they see ghosts so easily and readily that it's often difficult for them to tell the difference between people who are alive and people who are dead. And I've had several of them, you know, I've interviewed a number of mediums, and several of them have told me this. So absolutely, these ghosts look very, very real.
I think that's very, very intriguing. And you know, Preston, you note that when an older building undergoes major renovation, that a type of reawakening of ghostly incidents can occur. This is what happened at the Roosevelt Hotel. They were doing refurbishing there, and all of a sudden the events started up again.
That's right, and I've run across that. You know, it's one of the ways hauntings occur. This is something I did when I studied hauntings. It's like, how is this happening? What are there things that can actually evoke a haunting? Why are some houses haunted and some aren't? And definitely remodeling a house can cause a haunting, because what happens is the former owner becomes angry and still feels like it's their house, the former owner who has passed on. And that absolutely does cause ghosts to become angry. And I think that's, you know, with the Roosevelt Hotel, that's difficult to say, because you know, generally that's not a person's home. But though some of the movie stars did live there for a while. But you know, there's different reasons some places become haunted. Often it's because there's a tragic accident there. But I have to tell you, in a good 20% of the cases that I researched, I'll say even 25, is people using a Ouija board and just kind of messing around with it. And as a result, that can cause some of the worst hauntings that I've investigated have been caused by Ouija boards.
Yes, you have a very powerful chapter on that as well. And, you know, when you think about it, for example, remember on Coast to Coast, George Norrie, that wonderful program host, was going to do a show actively using the Ouija board or having someone there present who was using it. And remember, at the last minute, he decided not to go through with it very wisely. And I remember Karen Dolan had interviewed him and was asking him about that. I guess that was rather a wise decision.
You know, probably, but I have to tell you, there are mediums who do use Ouija boards and mm-hmm. successfully. And I was able to visit a physical medium. This is someone who not only can communicate with spirits, allegedly, mm-hmm. but can move objects. And that was actually in another book I wrote, California Ghosts, and sort of a prequel to Ghosts of Greater Los Angeles. And she did what's called table tipping. And
yes.
I've heard of that. Table mm-hmm. lifting, it's also called table tapping. And it was amazing, actually. I first observed it as an outside observer, and I watched four people doing it. I thought, nah, this is fake, because it really kind of looked like they were tipping the table themselves. And so then I was able to do it myself with four other people, three of us in the medium, and really feel that table bucking and moving by itself. And finally I'm like, oh, you know what, I just want to do it with the medium, just her and me. And so we were able to do it. I told her, just put one finger on the table. And she was able to do it with one finger. And it would just rise right up. And at one point, I was able to do it by myself. just for a brief moment, and I felt that table bucking under my hands, and there was no one touching it. So there is absolutely, this can be done safely. But I would recommend doing it with a professional medium. And, cause she had a meditation that we did before and afterwards. And I think perhaps, you know, that can be effective. So, you know, cause I don't want to discourage research. What I love about Ouija boards is it's easy access to the paranormal. You can just go on it and it's amazing, you know, some of the messages that have come through Ouija boards. For example, Seth, Jane Roberts, wrote a series of books that initially started through a Ouija board. And the books are really, you know, quite amazing, and they were bestsellers for many years. And so, you know, just be very, really, really careful. I wouldn't do it in your home, you know, if you've never done it before. But on the other hand, you know, I have to tell you, Patrice, how many people have done this? Probably, it used to be really popular in the, you know, the 60s and 70s and 80s. It was sold as a, you know, a game, along with Monopoly and, you know, Trouble and all those other games. And a lot of people have done this anyway, and they've come out of it fine. And for that matter, the people who've had severe hauntings, they survived that as well. So it's not, like, super, super dangerous. Just realize what you're getting into and take precautions.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you for that clarification. And, you know, Preston, on the fact that sometimes if there's reconstruction at an existing site or added construction ongoing there, if it's a really horrific incident, does the building have to be razed? Does it have to be destroyed? I don't. In our interview in April, you mentioned the unusual events that had occurred at various sites of the murders by the Manson gang.
Right.
And am I correct? I think it's in California, Ghosts. Am I correct that they did one of the homes to hopefully stop this paranormal activity?
Yeah, that is correct. And I think that does happen. But for the most part, I wouldn't recommend it. I think that eventually, you know, because we're, you know, it's hard to say. It's really hard to say. I don't know of a lot of houses that have been, destroyed as a result of a haunting. Mm-hmm. And in that case, it was the Manson case. That was true. But nowadays, it's in a lot of states, and I believe in California here where I am, it's the law. You have to reveal if a person has been murdered in that house or and in a few states, it's also the law, you have to reveal if the house is haunted because there was a lawsuit over that. So, you know, houses can be cleared. And in a lot of cases, people will live in a very, very haunted house and never experience any activity at all because for whatever reason, they don't provoke the ghost. And I think eventually hauntings do end. And certainly there's a whole an haunting. And ending haunting is basically a matter of communicating with the ghost and getting them to realize that they've passed on and that there are people, you know, who can take care of them. There's another side that they can go to. So I guess that's my point.
Yeah, that's true as well. And Preston, if you just speak up a little louder, and I'm sorry, I will be returning to the network room at the break just to get their questions. But pardon all this audio noise on here. I think Joe can still hear me, I'm hoping. And we'll just proceed right ahead here. You know, Preston, I also was very moved in your book by the account of a nurse who helped a friend's widower with a new baby after the wife had died giving birth. And what I thought, too, was very interesting. At the moment when she thought the wife's shade or wife's spirit left the home to apparently go to the new dimension, I would assume probably heaven, that there was an extreme buzzing sound. And, you know, sometimes abductees have heard buzzing sounds. Do you think that could perhaps, the buzzing reflects traveling through dimensions? What do you think?
I think that there is some validity to that. And I think also you got to be very careful when you try and mix these phenomena.
Yes.
I know people have tried to, there's a recent movement out to explain UFO abductions as lucid dreaming. And people have tried to explain them as near-death experiences and sleep paralysis and things like this. So, which I think is not. But absolutely, there does seem to be some real commonalities, and that buzzing is one of them. And I have to tell you, in the out-of-body literature, and this is another thing I've experienced, right before you go out of body, you feel that buzzing. It's similar to being kind of electrocuted in a way, is how it feels. It's very strong, and at least that was my experience, and certainly I've read many other accounts like that. And I think that's kind of the place between the dimensions, the area where one vibratory state kind of transforms or into another, a higher state. So I don't know, does that make any sense?
It surely does, and thank you. And you know what I noticed, too, from your book, the two accounts there, both when the young lady who had died giving a birth went home, the description is she was in a circle. There were lights all around her. Then lights began appearing like on the wall. It sounded like really quite a remarkable event. But the description does bear some similarities to one regarding, I think the young man's name was Eric, when his grandmother's shade left the home. I guess the grandmother was very concerned about the well-being of the family. They had particular financial concerns. And I just see a similarity, the tremendous light manifestations, the very quick movement around the house of the object. Very intriguing.
Yeah, it's amazing all the different ways that ghosts can manifest. And they can come to fruition, so they can move very heavy objects. Ghosts are really nothing to be afraid of in both of those cases. You know, these were really people who were in love with each other, basically, who were really good friends, trying to contact each other and kind of pierce through the veil of death, and were able to do so successfully to an amazing degree where, you know, they could shoot lights around the room, literally. And really, it's a wonderful, wonderful way for people to say goodbye. And it's extremely helpful to those who've been left behind here, who feel, you know, very, very abandoned in a way. I think death is much harder on those who survive, who are left behind, and because they feel this person's absence, and they don't know where they are, and they... A lot of people, you know, while they may have faith in life after death, have no experience with it. So something like this is extremely validating for people who've lost a loved one. And not that uncommon, again, in like, I forget what the exact statistics are, but I know that well over 50% of people do experience some form of what they interpret to be communication from a lost loved one. So this is... I think we're slowly getting a much better grasp of what ghosts are. We're beginning to accept them more and more in society. Certainly there's a lot of shows on TV about ghosts, which reflects that, you know, ghosts are becoming mainstream, and which is good. Hopefully they'll teach them that's what they should do, because it shocked me when I found out ghosts were real, honestly. So it was sort of a transition out of UFO research, because I had so many UFO witnesses telling me that they were also seeing ghosts. I'm like, oh, great. I'm going to have to deal with this.
Yes, indeed. And you know, here by that comment, well, your comments there recall a reference in your book to the program Ghost Whisperer, and the fact that on the set they had paranormal activity, and it was acknowledged.
Yeah, and in fact, Jennifer Love Hewitt, who, you know, was the star of Ghost Whisper, she has made many public comments about these ghosts, and so have some of the other actors. And she's given several interviews, in fact, in which she described it. And I saw some of the footage of you know, ghostly shadows moving behind her and things like this. And you know, they've had lights falling, you know, for no reason, and lots of electromagnetic activity and all kinds of stuff. So it's very interesting. That's a lot of the stuff that happened was at Universal Studios, which I was able to talk to one of the security guards there. And lo and behold, this is like other areas that are very frequented by people for a long period of time, they become haunted. And certainly Universal Studios has some amazing cases. This security guard told me of a case about a little girl. I'll just tell you what happened. He was guarding one of the rides when someone reported a little girl running through. And he saw this little girl, actually. And he went to warn people, and they said, oh, that's just the ghost. The other security guards told him this. And sure enough, he saw the little girl go into the ride, but she never came out. Apparently, she had died on the ride. And this is a ghost that they've, they actually caught security footage of ghosts at Universal Studios, but they had to erase it after a certain period of time because it's actually automatically erased.
Right.
So evidence, really good evidence, was lost, unfortunately. But apparently there's a lot of activity going on at Universal Studios.
Yes, indeed. And one thing, too, that I find, actually, there are several aspects of your book that I found very intriguing. Also, your other books on ghosts. Preston, I find your references in this Ghost of Greater Los Angeles to have several very interesting aspects that I just mentioned. For example, you have haunting event references to Native American locations. Something I found really very compelling was the case of children being able to see young Native American children in full Native ceremonial dress playing in a cordoned-off area in Glendale, eastern Los Angeles County. The living and contemporary children wanted to play with their comrades here, but they couldn't. And apparently people believe that these Native American children were ghosts from another era. There also was a tragic massacre near that location.
Right, yeah, that's a really interesting case, and it is kind of a touching one because what I find interesting about it is how it all came to be revealed at all, which is kind of a coincidence. Several of the children were seeing these ghosts, and they didn't realize they were ghosts. They thought they were other children, and they were playing in, like you said, it was restricted. This is down in a wash, and you don't play in, the L.A. River, so to speak. And this is what they were doing, and dressed in these amazing leather with beadwork and feathers and the whole deal. And the kids started complaining to their parents, and the parents finally talked to each other and realized that, something strange is going on, and they went down with the children. One of these ladies did, actually, and her child was pointing to the ghosts, and the child could see the ghosts, but the mother couldn't. There was nothing there, but the child insisted there were, and that's when she realized, this is ghostly activity. And a lot of the children had seen them, but apparently none of the adults. I've run into this before. In fact, a lot of the people I've interviewed saw their ghosts as children. Another really similar case was two sisters. They woke up, screaming because their dead aunt was sitting in a chair next to them in the room looking at them. And the parents came running in, and the parents could not see the ghost at all. And the kids were pointing at it. She was right there, but the parents could not see her. So for some reason, children are... I guess because they're fresh from the other side, so to speak,
yes.
They've still got that energy. Or perhaps, because I don't think it's just a matter of being skeptical. There's something biologically going on or something mental going on that is allowing children to see ghosts and adults not. And this is true with really old people, and particularly right before passing on. Near deathbed visions.
Yes.
This is a very, very common word. People in the state of passing on will see ghosts that the people around them cannot see. So the lesson here is that these ghosts are always around us. And that is, I think, what is really happening. And that privacy, as we think of it, is an illusion because ghosts can see us. They can hear us. And in many cases, they seem to be able to read our thoughts as well. And the veil between the worlds is much thinner than we realize. And for some reason, it's structured as a one-way mirror, where the ghosts can see us and we can't see them. because we're not at the right vibratory rate. This is the explanation that's most usually put forth. We vibrate at a slower rate, and they vibrate at a much higher rate, and it's less dense. But otherwise, it's the worlds are very similar, and that there's trees and landscapes and rivers and mountains and what have you.
So, boy, that's intriguing. Mm-hmm. And may I ask you a question, Preston? I noted that there was a little bit of a dichotomy there. For example, you'd have a report where a young roommate, Tony, and his friend, living in an Inglewood home there, experienced a benign haunting from a former owner, a charming lady, a widow who was just interested that the home be maintained properly, the garden, so forth, versus, for example, an account by a lady, Shelley, who wanted to visit a haunted hotel room in Louisiana's French Quarter with her husband, but she had to leave right away because it presented aspects of danger for them.
It's true. Some ghosts are absolutely hostile. And in that case, with the haunted hotel, this ghost things out of her hand.
Mm-hmm.
And and also tried to push her into the street.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
So ghosts can be hostile. And there's another case in the book where very, very similar.
Yes.
Where a woman was pushed off a bar stool while she was eating lunch. This was in a haunted bookshop.
Yes.
And there are many cases where ghosts will lock people in rooms as well. And these are, so there was one case, you know, this is also in the book, where the ghost would lock this one child in the room and none of the other kids. And they had a door that had no latch on it. There was nothing, you know, holding the door open or closed. And still, they could not open this door, and they had to remove the window on a couple occasions. You know, and they finally ended up taking the door off. And in another occasion, they couldn't open their freezer door to the refrigerator for a period of 3 days, and then suddenly it could open. And and there are other cases. Another person was locked in the bathroom. It's very, very interesting the way ghosts, you know, try to affect the environment. And certainly there are ones that are, you know, angry. And as a rule, I think a lot of ghosts are what you would call mentally disturbed or emotionally disturbed. But that's differentiated from spirits of loved ones who come to, you know, visit you to impart some wisdom or what have you, give a gift or just say hello. So for the most part, I don't think ghosts are that dangerous. I really don't. Certainly try to get as close to them as I can, and I've seen some activity, and I've had my hair tugged a couple of times, or I've had been poked. I've never been pushed, but I've certainly, you know, been close to ghosts and not suffered from it.
Just did some excellent research there. So, President, you would probably say that the greatest percentage of hauntings would either be of a benign nature or even just neutral nature.
Yeah, I think for the most part, ghosts are not out to hurt people. They're
mm-hmm.
and they're either there with a mission, trying to get through, or they're trying to be noticed.
Mm-hmm.
In other cases, they may not even realize, you know, that they're affecting the environment around them. It's really interesting. You know, there are a couple of cases, you know, speaking of how ghosts manifest, I found several cases where ghosts manifest only in mirrors. Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel is just one example.
Yes.
But there was another case where the ghost would only be seen in the mirror. And I've run across other cases like that as well. So I think there's something about mirrors that it's really interesting, and certainly there's a long tradition of mirror magic and, you know, summoning spirits through mirrors, and so I don't know quite what it is about a reflective surface, you know, that seems to kind of cause a little bit of a thinning of the veil or a tool to communicate with ghosts, but it's been used for that purpose, apparently, in many, many cases.
That's very intriguing, and I think that one of your very powerful accounts in the book, the one that concerned Era, also was referencing the fact that certain objects can seem to be haunted.
Right. You know, it's not just houses that are haunted. Sometimes it's the person that's haunted, or sometimes it's the object. In this case with the haunted bookshop, they were fine for years and years until suddenly, you know, this lady orders some books and is kind of, you know, a witch, I guess is the best description of it. And she ordered these books on magic, dark magic, black magic, or whatever, what have you. And they were very rare books, and it took them a long time to find them. That was kind of their specialty, is finding rare books. And no sooner had, you know, they gotten these books into their bookshop when they started having all kinds of problems with doors not opening, or being, you know, pushed off stools. I pushed some, you know, I've already mentioned some of the stuff that has occurred there. But they had a real problem with it until they got rid of those books. And even then they had problems afterwards.
Very intriguing. Yes. Pardon my interruption there again, Preston. You know, something too that I found was to me very new, new information as well, was the fact that in your research, you're looking into the phenomena when one actually perceives a ghost, and you noted that in several of the accounts, the paranormal image is seen out of the corner of the eye, and you know that there's been some discussion on this among researchers, and they think that one reason for this anomaly of the person only being permitted to see the object, not the straight-on vision, and I'm just quoting here, that the cones in our eyeballs that capture photons and project them onto the retina are specialized to capture movement and may be more sensitive to ghostly phenomena than the cones in the center of our retinas, end quote, pages 153 and 154 of your book. Boy, that really intrigues me.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely true. This is something that turns up again and again, and I think a lot of people have had that experience where they see something flitting out of the corner of their eye, whether it's just a little flash of light or a shadow or just movement. This is one of the theories. You know, there are many cases where cameras will actually capture a ghost on film that people cannot see. You know, one example I had of myself for myself was I went to visit the Queen Mary, which is one of the most haunted places around here. It's in Long Beach, and you can actually go on board. And I went on their ghost tour, and they took us to various haunted places, and there's a lot of activity there. And I took my camera, and I was taking part of the haunted pool room. And, you know, I didn't notice it at first, but later on I realized that I caught an image of an orb, sort of a round ball of light up in the corner of the room there, which is, you know, these orbs often appear in photographs. And I have this guy who experiences all kinds of ghost activity, a friend of mine, and who I actually interviewed and became a very good friend. And he sends me all these photographs that are taken of him by other people, and they always have orbs in them. He always has orbs in every photograph that he's in. It's the craziest thing. So, again, he has a lot of ghost activity. So these orbs are definitely another way that we are bringing technology and recording this stuff and building up a whole mountain of evidence that really should be convincing enough, and, you know, to convince a skeptic, I think.
Yes, I think so as well. Those are very good points. And, you know, Preston, there's one case I was just considering this morning. I don't know why. I was just here organizing, and it was rather compelling. It was about two, they basically met well. One was a trucker. They were visiting the Forest Lawn Cemetery at night. They had been told by friends that there were such things as ghosts, but I guess these two persons had been having kind of a fun evening, and they might have imbibed some beers. And when they approached the Forest Lawn Chapel, they ran into an apparition. No really description is given, but it frightened the heck out of them. In that case, were they right to just continue running? Do you think if they'd stopped, they might have been just so frightened they might have had a heart attack? What do you think?
you know, they, what I love about that case is they were skeptics. And they, this ghost was, I think, what you would describe as a hostile ghost. And it, whether or not it had the ability to hurt them or not, they never found out. Because they, what they saw was this apparition coming out of kind of the crucifix there, the altar. And it was definitely hostile. It was menacing. And it was definitely there to attack them. That's what they felt. So they just turned and ran. What would have happened if they'd, you know, stopped? I don't know. do attack people in some cases and possess, you know, people. And I've certainly run across that in my research. So I don't know what would have happened. I think in their case, they made a good decision in just continuing to leave. And they didn't see what, you know, how far the ghost followed them, but presumably it followed them for a little while at least. So I don't know. I don't know, but I can say that there are other cases in Forest Lawn. People have seen, you know, military ghosts, ghosts of soldiers. And I've talked to a number of people who've, you know, done sort of what do you call that again, using a tape recorder to record ghosts' voices.
Yes, I wish I were in the room because they could help me with this. The electronic voice recording, I'm trying to think of the correct acronym. Yes.
EVP, mm-hmm. Electronic voice phenomena.
Yes.
And I know this guy who went to various graveyards, and this is what he would do. He would take a recorder and try to, you know, turn it on, and apparently it's just a very simple process. You use a normal tape recorder, ask questions and try and look, and in some cases, they answer. Ghosts are able to affect electromagnetic equipment more easily than, you know, making a full-blown apparition. And this is why I think we see lots of TVs going on and off, lights going on and off, and various things like this, radios, because ghosts are able to affect these things pretty easily. And so this is the theory behind EVP. And he was able to effectively get some really startling messages that he felt were genuine. And for me, it's a kind of spooky way of doing ghost research is going to graveyards. But certainly graveyards are very well known for being haunted. And another one of those, if you want to see a ghost, going to a graveyard is definitely one of the places you can see ghosts. Which is actually one of the reasons that I wrote this book, Ghosts of Greater Los Angeles, because I would say at least half of the cases in there are public hauntings, places you can go to see the ghosts yourself. And I actually included a whole list of 30 or so cases in the back of the book of other well-known haunts. So certainly there's no excuse for being skeptical. If you want to see a ghost, you can go out there and see one.
Very well said, and it's an excellent work. I very heartily would recommend Ghosts of Greater Los Angeles. It's been available now since this past summer. A very popular book, and it's a very engaging read, very informative one as well. Also, your California Ghosts and other works are very interesting. Lots of very intriguing cases there. Now, we will be returning in about 8 minutes' time. The next hour will be focused on Preston's ufology work and other field work. Preston, could you stay on the line? We'll be right back in 8 minutes. And everyone, thanks so much for joining us. And I'm going right back now to the radio room to get some questions, I bet, that are waiting for us there. Back at 8 there, Preston. Thank you.
Dollar, small material, I believe scholar, had a PhD. horizon. Apologize, it's been some kind of stress. Doesn't even feel the effects when he says. Not to count how many have been blessed. Falls off track, starts smoking crack. Once it hits his brain, starts to chain react. Tells the shirt off his back, shoes off his feet. Losing all his teeth, now he's out in the street. All of a sudden, it's like Jesse James trying to stick up to his phone and watches him change. Raised from business school and is nervous with the tools. So he ends up on his back in a bloody pool. For the hands, people were robbed, they mugged by the cold hands. That bitch on the cold hands. Sometimes kids get murdered.
Gia Scott's Dawn of Shades is featuring a new series this fall, one that is sure to catch your attention. It's the Music in America series, and it runs from November 15th through January 3rd, each Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific. We're going to start the journey off with Keith Sekola, a fresh Native American Rock Hall of Fame inductee, and the journey will end with Buddy Cage from the New Riders of the Purple Sage. In between, we're going to talk with a country artist from Montana, a pop singer from New York City, a heavy metal artist fresh from Alaska, and even a busker in New Orleans, along with a whole lot more. It will be a unique experience for music fans as we find out who the artist really is and what it's really like to be in the industry. You won't want to miss this. You can also read more at www.exogenynetwork.com.
Hello, everyone. Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Come join us each Friday evening at A Global Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
The Church of Mabus Radio Show is now in session. Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern, with high strange scholars teaching us of ufology, the paranormal, the occult, and the metaphysical. Seek sanctuary with the Dark Reverends, Jeffrey Pritchard and Guy Widell at www.mabusincarnate.com. Always moshing with the apocalypse. Now get down on your knees and pray.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the second hour of A Global Focus with guest Preston Dennett, author, ufologist, ghost hunter, and paranormal researcher and pioneer. The most recent of Preston Dennett's 14 books are Ghosts of Greater Los Angeles, published this summer, and UFOs Over New Mexico, a true history of extraterrestrial encounters in the land of enchantment. The book will be released this winter. Welcome back, everyone, to the second hour with our discussion with guest Preston Dennett. And Preston's website, again, can be found at PrestonDennett.Weebly.com. Correct, Preston?
That's right.
It's a wonderful website. Great research. Now, Press, if you just, to our wonderful network owner, Joe Montaldo, just to make sure that Preston's volume is increased a little bit so we can all hear him, because everyone wants to hear Preston. Not me so much, but definitely Preston. And, you know, during the break, I ran into the UPRN, metaphorically, ran into the UPRN network room. Several questions. They're really enjoying your information there, Preston. First question is from an individual who's a policeman there in our northeast area, a cop. He wonders if, Preston, if you take a picture of a ghost, can that ghost travel with you and be released when at home? Can they follow you home?
Absolutely. I don't think taking a picture necessarily means that, but that it's going to follow you. And I think that's probably rare for the most part. I think when a ghost becomes attached to a person, it's usually because they can sense it in some way, and the ghost realizes that, that sort of mediums sort of emit, I guess, more astral light. You know, this is the theory. I don't quite understand it, but for some reason, ghosts are able to recognize who can see them and who can't, or who responds to them. So that can really be the type of person who would be in danger of bringing this home. But for the most part, I wouldn't say it's a big danger. And trying to photograph a ghost or actually being successful at that, I wouldn't say that that would necessarily be dangerous in terms of, you know, bringing a ghost home. And even if that should occur, ghosts, if you speak to them, particularly, you know, right after a manifestation occurs, they can hear you. And you can demand your space, certainly, and you can do meditations with white light and that sort of thing to cleanse ghosts, or sage your home. That's another method that's supposedly pretty effective. So there are methods that you can use to, you know, clear a home if you have a problem with it as well.
Thanks very much for that information, Preston. Now we have a question coming in from our researcher, Steve Nance, and his nick here is Mar Steve. Intriguing question. Now, Steve would often speak with Dr. Alan Hynek via the phone and I'm sure too in person. Now, Dr. Alan once told him that he, Dr. Hynek, believed that the UFO alien question may be as much one of an extra-dimensional phenomenon as an extraterrestrial one.
Yes. That is a good question. I'm glad Steve brought that up because this is one of the theories behind UFOs. I'm a big believer that we're dealing with aliens, you know, in the classic sense, extraterrestrials. But as far as extra-dimensional or interdimensional, I think that absolutely is something these ETs have mastered. And I would remind everyone that we ourselves are interdimensional creatures. And while we don't have a huge, great understanding of it, there are people who are able to effectively go out of body, you know, at will, and really travel to the other side and go to other dimensions. And so we ourselves, I guess the point I want to make is that the ETs have a really good understanding of this. And I think this is what we're seeing in a lot of these cases where UFOs will shrink down to tiny balls of light and move that way. They're not really flying conventional set. They appear out of nowhere, they're hovering, and then they disappear. And certainly there are many cases where UFOs will kind of turn transparent and become invisible. And they really have mastered this whole thing to a greater degree, at least some of them, than we have. And I think that's what we're seeing here. Because my problem with the whole interdimensional explanation is it's kind of vague, and it's very hard to grasp and kind of get an understanding of what dimension these ETs would be coming from. And, you know, do they exist on other planets, other cities? Because these are things, these objects are appearing on radar. They're absolutely affecting fields. There are some 3,000 landing trace cases that are well recorded.
Yes.
And they're affecting people's bodies as well, you know, with the whole abduction cases. These are physical things we're dealing with. So if you're going to describe something as interdimensional, you have to explain how they manifest and how they're able to become physical. But you know, I don't really have a problem with the interdimensional theory. I think it's kind of part of the whole extraterrestrial theory. I think that are kind of the same thing in a way. Because I think physics is showing this anyway, that our universe is interdimensional. There are many different dimensions. And I think what we're seeing is a case of UFOs kind of flying in and out of them.
Boy, well said there. And the next question, Preston, is from our researcher, Norris Boyd. He's wondering if, how can you tell, Preston, if a house or the property is haunted? Is there a different way to exorcise the things you don't want there? Thanks, Norris Boyd. Great question.
Certainly there are ways to tell if a house is haunted. And then I think the back of the book, I listed all the different ways that ghosts will manifest. And for the most part, the most common ways people realize, oh, my house is haunted, is they hear ghostly footsteps. They are sure that they did not move an object that is, you know, suddenly missing or move to a different location. Doors will open and close by themselves. TVs going on and off. Toilets flushing, that's something that's pretty common. Do you think if you have a ghost in your house, you'll know it? It's sort of like one of those things, like, well, it reaches a threshold, and you're like, all right, you know, there's no one in the room there, other than yourself, and then something falls off the shelf, or something like that. These are the ways I think that you can pretty much tell that your house is haunted. On the other hand, some ghosts can be very, very quiet and will never reveal themselves at all, except kind of by the feeling of a presence. And if you're especially sensitive to this, you'll find that most homes are haunted, I think. And certainly there are ghosts all over the place, running back and forth. So I think it's difficult for people who, you know, and this is happening more and more to people. More and more people are becoming sensitive to this kind of thing. And it's not as rare as it used to be, that's for sure, where people have this ability to see ghosts. And what I think is really interesting, and all the people I've interviewed, this is just another weird fact, compared to men and women, like, for instance, with UFOs, it's pretty much 50-50 of the people I've interviewed in terms of, you know, who's had an experience. But with ghosts, it's like twice as many women as men. So that's another thing to consider when you're, you know, talking about ghosts.
You know, that's very interesting, and I've got three more excellent questions here. My quick comment on that would be the aspect, I don't want to say emotion, but just the very strong feelings that might evoke the presence of a ghost.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, definitely evoke the presence of a ghost of a loved one, for example. Like just someone who you know really, really well, and if you could meditate on them, absolutely, they will come to you if they're available. And especially if this is something you do on a regular basis at a regular time. And certainly meditation is something all the enlightened masters, I guess I'll call them, all the really holy people, you know, in the various religions for that matter, agree upon. It's one of the very few things. And I think it's really effective if you want to, you know, become sensitive to spirits and try and see this stuff. And it's not hard to do.
Well, it's helpful information. And, Preston, our next question is from our researcher, Eagle with Crown Ore. Very intriguing comment here. Eagle wonders, Preston, have you ever used the Frank Box mechanism, for example, with the radio frequencies to communicate with beings from other dimensions? Where, for example, that they have I wish now that I could see the screen in the room. If I understand the Frank Box and some of these other modalities, you have it so that it's kind of like a random radio transmission, and then a response seems to be randomly or automatically generated to a question.
No, I haven't, and I haven't actually heard a whole lot about this, but my comment would be that there are many cases where UFOs have affected, you know, radios and cell phones and things like, in fact, an article about that, about cases where people had seen UFOs, and at the same time their cell phone will start ringing, or they'll answer it, and there'll be a strange voice on the line, and or really weird sounds, clickings, and things like this. And so there are a number of cases where, as well, weird Morse code type of sounds that come through radios in the presence of a UFO. So yes, I think this can be an effective method to communicate with, you know, interdimensional or extraterrestrial beings. And other than that, though, I haven't really seen a whole lot about it. I really don't know a whole lot about it.
So it was an interesting response there, Preston. And we have another question coming in now from our cop who says, have you ever seen more than one ghost arguing or talking or disagreeing? And I guess in this case it will be, have you ever heard of reports from witnesses of more than one ghost arguing or talking or disagreeing?
I personally haven't, but absolutely this does occur in many cases, in fact, because I mean, there was one gentleman I interviewed, and he saw exactly that. And in fact, what happened is it was a huge altercation, and it ended up in murder. One of the people murdered the other, which is what actually caused the haunting. So that does happen. In fact, it's not terribly uncommon. People will hear group conversation coming from another room, involving even parties, full on with music and everything. So that does occur as well. And I think that arguing does occur as well because in cases of tragic deaths, often there's, you know, that kind of thing going on. A lot of emotion, I should say.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be terribly uncommon for that reason as well. But, you know, each case is different. Each case is
yes.
absolutely unique. And everyone's experiences, you know, as individual as they are. Certainly there are patterns that are very prominent. And ghosts come in all kinds of numbers. There are even cases, you know, where there are, you know, lots of ghosts, huge them. So that's pretty rare.
Thank you. And now our next question is from a new visitor to the room, Ghost Rider. Hi, Ghost. Ghost Rider. He was just recounting some of the people in text, the fact that he and a friend have been researching a possible ghost in the friend's home, something about a possible broken heart situation with that former residence. It must have been a situation in the past, and there's an apparent, or there could very well be an apparent ghost in the home now. Now, he was wondering, too, he's thinking to himself, if perhaps and to us as well, if perhaps that Patrick Swayze, the movie Ghost, starring Patrick Swayze, wasn't that far off the mark.
Yeah, you know, that's what I really liked about it. It went a little bit farther than a lot of ghost movies you see. And
yes.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting was where on the subway, where one of the ghosts, I don't know the actor's name, but he was teaching Patrick Swayze how to move objects.
Yes,
trash
wow.
cans and you know, things like this.
Mm-hmm.
So through a process of building up vital energy, which I think might be exactly, you know, similar to how it does occur in real life. And they didn't do a whole lot of exploring of what's like on that show, which I think they could have done, and I think some movies have done that more effectively. But absolutely, it was. You can see from that movie how frustrating it must be for ghosts who are talking to a medium or trying to get their message across, and how difficult it is for them to see, you know, their loved ones grieving when they're right there. And not only are they fine, they're better than fine. You know, death, ironically, you know, is as bad as it can get. But right after it, you're on the other side, and it's great. You know, you're young again. You don't have any illnesses. It's a wonderful, wonderful high-energy place. And it's a very healing experience, ultimately. So,
That does sound very reassuring. And now our next question is coming. We have two more, actually probably three more, but I'll be brief here. They're very interested in your comments, Preston. Now, this individual is the host of a very popular program, Chip Mind Cemetery. Now, Chip's question is, Preston, what experiments have you run during your investigations? Do you do anything with the flashlight, for example? And do you ever test the ghost's ability to comprehend or the ability to see visual things, such as colors and shapes?
No, I haven't had a whole lot of opportunity to, you know, do an active communication with the ghost, and that, you know, is pretty rare. I understand that, you know, no, I have not had that opportunity. And with regard to the flashlight, I'm not sure what that means. I know that there are cases where people have communicated, you know, using various technologies that I forget what it's called, but there's this instrument that you can use that will buzz in the appearance of a ghost, and the ghost can actually affect it to where it will buzz once for yes, twice for no.
I've seen that just lately, yes, just on television.
Right, and there's other people who have been able to communicate with ghosts that when ghosts have the ability to flicker a light, for example.
Mm-hmm.
In a Morse code type pattern.
Yes.
Usually just yes or no. So we're not at the point yet, I don't think, where we can use technology to communicate with ghosts. But you know what? That is a definite possibility, and I think we're taking the first steps towards that. Certainly that's what EVP, that's the whole purpose of EVP. We ask a question and the ghosts answer. I foresee a time in the future, hopefully, where, you know, we can do this with technology, and wouldn't that be something?
Thank you. No, that's very intriguing. And, well, I'm trying to find my very last question, and this was from one of our researchers here, Goddess of Fire, asked a very intriguing question. Now, I'm hoping I'm correctly remembering this, that you had references some ghosts are troubled. Now, could I just add something here? From your book, it might not just be a traumatic incident. The ghost might be concerned about family, such as that the ghost of the grandmother who was worried about her family. There apparently was an insurance policy that the daughter and grandson could benefit from, but the location, existence of that policy had to be made known to the living.
Right. I love that case because that's a pretty rare case, but there's a number of them where ghosts have come back to, you know, point people out to where there's a will or where there's something just like that. They were, in this case, they needed that money and would have lost it otherwise. So this spirit saved them just in time. And no, it's not always a tragic death. There's a number of reasons. It can be because someone just loves their house. It can be because somebody was addicted to drugs or alcohol and are physically craving it, or you know, whatever addiction they might have. It can be just because they're coming to visit, because they don't know they're dead. And in some cases, it can be because of, you know, revenge, for that matter, if they're really angry with a person. But in most cases, I don't think people have anything to worry about in terms of becoming a ghost. And I think the transition, especially for people, you know, who are expecting it or are, you know, aware of life after death, at least, there shouldn't be a problem.
Thank you. That's very reassuring. And, you know, Preston, and thanks again, Goddess of Fire, for that excellent question. And to the other researchers as well, thanks. Always appreciated. I always add so much to the shows. Now, Preston, oh boy, am I looking forward to discussing ufology next. You're a wonderful ghost hunter, a wonderful researcher in the full spectrum of the paranormal fields. But, you know, here, ufology, too, particularly interests me as well. This January, your latest book, UFOs Over New Mexico, A True History of Extraterrestrial Encounters in the Land of Enchantment. Oh, boy, you couldn't have chosen a better state for your research focus. New Mexico not only has that beautiful landscape and hence its name, Enchantment, but it's known for those key cases such as Roswell, Aztec, San Augustine, and, of course, that controversy over Dulce. I can't wait to see this book. Read it. Boy.
Yeah, I'm really excited. You know, I've been doing UFO research for well over 20 years now, or at least 20 years, and I'm still learning stuff, and it's really, you know, that I did a whole lot of research for that book, and it's shocking how much information there is, and certainly all the cases where UFOs have hovered right over White Sands and Holloman and Alamogordo and the whole nuclear test site there.
Yes.
To really, really bring a strong correlation between UFOs and atomic power. And certainly, it doesn't seem to be a coincidence that the modern age of UFOs began pretty much the same time, coincides exactly with the atomic era. And this is the cases in New Mexico reflect that. To a huge degree. I mean, there's so many cases of where rockets are sent off, and these UFOs are flying around them and caught on radar and seen with a theodolite, which is a telescope and a camera, so they're able to kind of track them. And so the number of cases, it's astounding. And in New Mexico, it stretches back, you know, over 100 years, in fact. So it's been going on for a very long time.
Well, that's intriguing. You know, that recalls to me the interview and the work research, rather, of James Clarkson. James Clarkson had written a very interesting book, Tell My Story, June Crane, The Air Force and UFOs. And I know I had the chance to read the transcript he had done with June Crane, and they do mention the sightings in New Mexico. Very credible, very detailed reports coming in about the sightings at those locations. And also, you know, Preston, I was going over your work, UFOs, over Topanga Canyon, and you were referencing the importance of the Santa Monica Range there in California for being the site of so many UFOs. But there are several mountain ranges in New Mexico as well. Do you think that could be a factor or no?
You know, I don't think it's a huge factor, if it is. I think there's something, because UFOs are seen all over the place. And they're common in pretty much every state. I mean, there's certainly no place that hasn't had a UFO sighting, but, you know, not in the United States for sure. And it appears to be the same case in other countries. So some states are more... have a lot more sightings than others. California is a leader, as well as Washington, I believe, is the leader, and Texas is. There are some states that do have more sightings than others. In most cases, these are high population states. I don't know if mountain ranges have a huge effect on where a UFO appears. But there are some cases where UFOs have appeared over mines, you know, where people do digging for various elements. And this does seem to be the case in New Mexico, because New Mexico is very, very rich, particularly uranium. And that could be one of the reasons we have a lot of UFO activity there.
That's a very intriguing response. Now, Preston, returning the subject to UFOs in California. Are there any new developments with unidentified submersible objects, USOs, or water UFOs, as Carl Fine calls them, off the California coast? I note from that excellent UFOs over Topanga Canyon, references to sightings over Malibu, and other programs you've mentioned, the growing number of sightings of UFOs over the coastal waters there, well, California itself.
Right. No, you know, there hasn't. It seems to be pretty quiet right now. And that could be because I've been, you know, concentrating a lot on putting out a couple of these books recently, and I haven't had time to go out there and, you know, pound the streets, if you will. No, it's been pretty quiet for the most part. There is a lot of activity going on now, I know that. The UFO Reporting Center and MUFON have been receiving a flood of reports, particularly all throughout October. And, you know, this is from all over the place, Connecticut, California, Washington, Florida. So there's a lot of activity going on right now. In fact, there was just a case last week, which occurred right here near where I live. I live in Canoga Park, California, and this case occurred in the neighboring district, West Hills, just a few miles away. And this gentleman was out at 1:30. This was, I think, October 25th or so, and he saw a huge, silent, triangular-shaped craft. And it was a clear night, and it was making no noise, even though it appeared to be really quite large and low, just a, you know, a few hundred feet. And it just moved off into the distance. So there's a lot of activity going on right now, which I find kind of interesting, but not a whole lot with the underwater stuff. I don't know why.
Just intriguing. You know, how could I say this? Well, just to be a little bit cryptic here, one of the brightest researchers I know is wondering if perhaps the increase in UFO sightings might be attributable to concerns over the air quality and the Fukushima Daiichi events. I don't know, or does that just sound too way out? We have been hearing more results of more counts of sightings here.
I think that that could be a factor, because I do know that when someone has taken on board a UFO, the first thing is they're examined. I may have mentioned this before, but I think it bears repeating. The second thing is that these ETs warn us of environmental destruction due to the way we're treating our environment and ourselves. And they warn of nuclear proliferation. This is true in the contactee era in the 50s, and it's true today with abductees. This is a very, very common theme on that and alternative healing. We see this again and again. So, and I think, you know, the area, well, tangent, but the area where UFO research is really volatile and important right now is ending this cover-up, because what we're dealing with is a situation where we could end the energy crisis, the economic crisis, and the environmental crisis all at once in one fell swoop by just releasing the ET technology of free energy, so we don't rely on oil and burn all these fossil fuels, and just the amount of money that goes into the black budget is incredible, and into defense and things like this that it's not accountable. So we're dealing with, you know, a really volatile situation here, and certainly the UFOs could end the cover-up at any moment, but they know better than that, because they're going to wait until, you know, we stop having wars and stop killing each other and things like this. They know better than to disrupt human society to a point where it can't function, and their appearance might do that until we get our things together. So we need to end this UFO cover-up, and I think it's dissolving pretty quickly.
That's beautifully said, Preston. Very strong arguments there. Well, you know, Preston, you've done absolutely first-rate research in this field. For example, your research on the Coronado Island incident, I'm mentioning that because we have a wonderful abduction expert, Yvonne Smith, who is currently presenting on this particular subject as well. Is there further news here on the Coronado Island? I know it's one where you wrote an excellent book on it with your co-author, though most of your books you are the sole author of. The Coronado Island incident did involve one of the experiencers having an implant removed by Dr. Roger Lear.
That's right. It's an astounding case. And one of the you know, rarer types of cases, it's multiple witnesses involving, you know, 8 to 10 adult witnesses, each of who had an experience in the same location on the same night, which makes it not unique in that way, but also had an enormous amount of physical evidence, a lot of medical evidence. And as you say, an implant was removed. And Yvonne was actually the main researcher who hypnotize all these people.
And, excellent. Mm-hmm.
So she's got quite a bit of stuff to say about it. And the person I wrote the book with was one of the percipients. And he was very eager to get his story out right away. And because he thought it was a very important case. And I agree.
I hope I noted his name correctly.
Well, his name is Mike Evans.
Yes, I did say that good. Mike Evans, yes.
Yeah.
Well, and that's really excellent research there. You know, Preston, I heard you discuss that the Coronado incident at the Bayside UFO conference. I believe it was 2008. And you were mentioning the full spectrum of ETs visiting the planet. And you know what I found very helpful as well were the graphs and the pictures that you as well showed, the slides that your sister Christina, Christine Kasaradenic, I'm embarrassed here, that is her correct first name, correct? She's a wonderful artist. Some very powerful renditions there of from details of individuals who had seen the various types of ETs. She has a wonderful blog there. And let me see if I can't get that up right here so other people can not only see your excellent site, PrestonDennett.Weebly.com, but also Christina's, because I know even for fellow researchers, your work is absolutely first rate. And when you can see the image as well of these beings, it's very helpful.
Oh, yeah. No, I've been working with Kisara since the beginning, really for like 20 years now. She's my sister-in-law. She's married to my brother.
Wonderful. Can I just note, he's Christine Kasaradenic. The website, www.kasara, K-E-S-A-R-A.org. She also has a great blog.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's really amazing because she's worked really hard to sort of get accurate images of these ETs. And mm-hmm. worked very closely, you know, with me and with other UFO witnesses, including all the pictures in a lot of my books were done by her. And the Coronado Island UFO incident, she drew the ETs as described by the witnesses.
So, yes, and her blog spot is extraterrestrial.blogspot.com. But again, back to you, Preston. Preston, you're an outstanding researcher in this field with your number of books and presentations. Now you've written 14 books. But I want to go back to one of my favorites, and that is UFOs Over New York. And, you know, I was just looking at that today, and, boy, two interesting accounts. One was a 2006 report on a sighting over LaGuardia Airport, where the co-pilot viewed an intense flashing strobe light near their aircraft at an altitude of about 30,000 feet. He did once seeing this to the controller at LaGuardia, of course, and that controller indicated that from time to time he received that type of sighting report as well.
Oh, yeah, it's not all at all uncommon for pilots to see UFOs, and there's a number of cases like that in that book. They know about UFOs, but often they don't report them because of the whole ridicule factor.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So it's unfortunate, but yeah, there are a number of cases. There's one case where a plane was actually diverted to chase a UFO ordered by the military base. And mind you, this is a passenger plane filled with, you know, passengers. And they mm-hmm. chased this UFO for, you know, a good 20 miles or so, I believe, until, you know, at some point it became clear that they were never going to catch it. And it became a big controversy. Afterwards, the military base denied that they had ever done this. But the pilots gave a public report of it and were interviewed by the media and eventually UFO researchers. So it's an extraordinary case and only, you know, one of many like that with UFOs over New York, very active area.
You know, it is, and, you know, if I could mention one more of your excellent research reports here, that was the case December 13th, 2005. A large box-shaped object was seen both in Long Island and New York City. Co-workers from the 22nd floor of a building at One Court Square in Long Island viewed this object. It was hovering over a nearby construction site. The object was floating in the air. It wasn't part of the construction equipment. And interestingly enough, the construction workers themselves saw it. They were seen to be observing it. And fellow workers, I'm not sure whether it was the co-worker party or the construction party, had some of their fellow employees from New York City also see the same unusual large black box from their vantage point in New York City. That's really unusual. It also was reported to New Fork.
Right, right. You know what I love about that case is, and this is not your typical flying saucer. This is doesn't have, you know, windows, and it's not round and silver, which is important to note because there's a lot of cases where UFOs are just really strange looking. This is just kind of a big black box. And due to the New York cases, it came right down in the middle of a very, very, very populated area where a lot of people could see it. And it was just circling around 59th Street.
Yes.
And just kind of going around this building and in full view of a lot of people. And it's really odd because, you know, each state kind of has their own flavor to their UFO activity. I've noticed this doing research with UFOs over California, UFOs over New York, and now UFOs over New Mexico. I'm working on another as well.
Oh.
And each area seems to have their own flavor. And in New York, boy, these objects come right down and are whizzing around the Empire State Building, hovering over the United Nations Building. And it's amazing how brazen and they are, as if they're putting on displays, which is a behavior that we do occasionally see with UFOs.
Boy, that's very intriguing. I know there's a selection with photos at the end of the book, UFOs Over New York, which is fascinating as well, in addition to the excellent. And also, now do I remember correctly here, you had a chapter on the Linda Cortili case. I hope I'm correctly pronouncing her name. Or a pseudonym. Yeah. I'm not sure whether that was her real name or not, but it was a fascinating case.
No, that isn't her real name. She's since gone public.
Mm-hmm.
It is her correct first name. But that case is, you know, one of the very few cases in which people have observed an abduction. And but what a lot of people don't know is it's certainly not the only case. And I wrote an article outlining 20 or more cases about, it was about a dozen cases. I'm sure it's up to 20 now. Or, you know, outside witnesses have observed people being abducted into UFOs. So this sort of thing does occur, and it was certainly true in that case. And it wasn't only Linda who was abducted on that particular case. There was a number of other people who had experiences that night, not beyond just sightings. So not only was it widely witnessed, it involved quite a number of people. And it was a very intriguing case, and I think one of the top 10 really important cases in New York. I mean, there's the Hudson Valley wave,
yes,
which was really probably New York's biggest UFO event. But that was also really, really big, this whole event, which occurred over the Brooklyn Bridge, of all places.
Yes.
New York is where Whitley Strieber came from, and the whole abduction movement of research really began largely in New York through Bud Hopkins, who just recently passed on, by the way.
Yes,
and,
unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Whitley Strieber and others. So it's been very important to the whole UFO movement and how we, you know, think and feel about UFOs.
Those are very good points. And, you know, Preston, I've noticed there have been some... hopefully, positive signs from the media. Not only do we have these wonderful shows coming up on the Discovery Show, Discovery Channel, History Channel, and Sci-Fi relating to the UFO questions, and I'm not talking about the scary melodramas, but we have several interesting programs. I'm noting here, for example, the Huffington Post now carries journalist Alejandro Rojas and Lee Spiegel's articles. Do you think there is a hope for the media?
I sure hope so, because you know there's a book out there called The Missing Times.
Yes.
I forget who wrote it. Hansen might be his last name.
Yes.
At any rate, it outlines how the media does, in fact, have, you know, censoring the subject of UFOs.
Robertson Campbell.
For a long,
yes,
time.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few cases I outlined like that in my book, UFOs Over New York. So, yeah, it's a new bet. I'm really happy. The more media we can have of this stuff. You know, Patrice, it's really interesting with UFOs. They're not going away, apparently.
And yes.
So every year we have at least one or two, sometimes three, maybe not every year, but, you know, periodically a really huge UFO case comes along, and it has just got so much evidence and so many witnesses that the media can't ignore it. And it becomes mainstream news, whether it's,
yes,
you know, Stevensville, Texas, or remember that Chinese airport that was shut down because a UFO was hovering over,
yes,
it?
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. And or O'Hara, where a UFO punched a hole through the clouds and it was seen by airport workers and pilots and witnesses on the ground. So this is a case where we have UFOs that are not going to go away, and I think we're going to have open official contact eventually. I think it's inevitable. And whether it occurs on our terms or theirs or whoever, I don't know how it's going to go down, but I just can't see the situation remaining the way it is forever. Not as the evidence builds and builds and builds.
Boy, those are strong points, and pardon me, I didn't mean to shout that. Preston, I was looking here for one of the names of one of the programs that are so wonderful now on the TV, an example being Ancient Aliens with Giorgio Tsoukalos appearing on that show, I believe, on a regular basis. But, you know, Preston, what you were just saying really rings a chord here, and that is, do you think that with advances in cell phones and video technology that there could be a mass sighting event which the media would be forced to cover, and it would prove an excellent case to prove the existence to the majority of the public of the UFOs? And here I'm thinking of some of the factors that might lead to disclosure, as noted in Richard Dolan and Bryce Sable's book, AD After Disclosure, The People's Guide to Life After Contact.
Yeah, I think that's exactly how it's going to go down. And we've pretty much had that several times. I mean, Mexico City during the eclipse, there was an enormous number of sightings. They were videotaped by over 50 people from different vantage points. And it was absolute proof. And down there in Mexico, because of that, largely, it's not nearly as much of a problem, skepticism, as it is here in the United States. But in Phoenix, Arizona, this object flew right over Phoenix and, you know, a lot of Arizona for that matter. And boy, did it cause a political uproar. Sending, you know, Luke Air Force Base really bungled that one badly by releasing conflicting statements about flares and what have you.
Absolutely.
At the same time, you know, the mayor, the congressman, or the governor, rather, actually saw the UFO and didn't tell anybody. And Frances Barwood, she was the councilwoman who tried to get information, and she could not get any information from any of the official sources. So it caused a huge political uproar and, you know, sent waves through our society. And thousands of people saw this thing. So this is how it's going to happen again. And, you know, we didn't get a whole lot of clear footage on that occasion, but, which is kind of surprising because it wasn't that long ago. But, you know, next time something like that happens, you can bet we're going to have a lot of people photographing this stuff, and it's going to be undeniable. It's going to happen sooner or later. Whether or not there's a platform for all this evidence to be displayed to everyone, that's another question. But hopefully, you know, the main news media channels will take it, or one of these shows who concentrate on UFOs, focus on UFOs. But either way, I think, you know, the evidence is out there. It really is.
And, you know, we're fast approaching the end of the interview. Preston, do you have any comments you'd like to make to the audience? I've learned, again, so very much from speaking with you this evening. Do you have additional projects that are ongoing? Well, your research is ongoing, but any particular projects? Also, I just wanted to mention again to our listeners that your book, UFOs Over New Mexico, will be available in January.
I would say that let's push towards getting this Roswell case busted wide open so we can see the UFO in a museum. I think that's got to happen eventually, and this cover-up has got to end. And that's the main reason I'm writing these books. I'm writing another one called UFOs Over Nevada. And Patrice, take a wild guess how much of Nevada is owned by the federal government.
A massive, tell me, I will guess a massive segment.
86%.
Wow.
And, so this is why there's a lot of UFO, you know, over Area 51 and things like this, because there's definitely, I'm amazed what I'm finding out doing research for this book. So that's where I'm at right now. I'm also writing another really exciting book of people who've had very, very close contact and taken on board a UFO or had face-to-face contact. And I'm finding out a lot of things on that one. There's a lot of people who have, you know, a lot of different types of ETs, human-looking, praying mantis type, grays, and just a huge wide variety. So it's a very exciting project for me, and hopefully that'll be coming up in the future as well. And I'll keep it announced on my website, which is my name, PrestonDennett.Weebly.com. And you can contact me through there as well if you'd like.
Excellent. Now, Preston, do you currently have a program? I was going to say, boy, we'd love to have you speak here. Do you currently have an ongoing program? You did in the past. It was very successful.
No, I don't. You know, I do various segments, you know, on shows, and I'm always happy to appear on shows like yours, which yours is one of my favorite, of course, because you really allow the speaker to speak, which is a lot of fun, you know, giving me time to get the information out. I appreciate that. But this time I don't. Something perhaps in the future I would consider.
Excellent, because I can definitely think of a group of listeners who would love to have you reporting on your research on a very regular basis. So, and I definitely will be discussing this with you and that other party. You're very much appreciated. Boy, you've given such great interviews on this network with Jill Montaldo, host of UFO Undercover, with Dee Andrew, Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, other excellent interviews. We'd like to hear more from you, definitely. It's research that's very timely, very helpful. Now, again, I would advise everyone to please visit his website, PrestonDennett.Weebly.com. And Preston, I hope to hear you presenting at more of the conferences. I loved your address there at the Bayside Ufology Conference. You've spoken at many. Any plans as far as that's concerned?
I probably will be speaking at the Ventura UFO Conference, which is held annually and was actually scheduled for November, but looks like it's being postponed to January.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I don't have anything really upcoming, but certainly open to it, and I have been working pretty hard lately, so I haven't been pursuing that avenue as much. But I definitely should start doing that more. Huh?
Well, as again, I don't mean to be overly repetitive here, but your presentations are excellent as well. Also, your workshop con, a lot of information is relayed, and people have the opportunity to ask very important questions. Important to them and also to the field. And I know you have a very busy day job as well. You're a very serious researcher and a very serious career professional, much to your credit. Well, I'll tell you one thing, Preston, I'm definitely going to be buying this UFOs Over New Mexico as well as your upcoming book, UFOs Over Nevada. I can't wait until they're released, and I hope you'll be a soon return guest. You promised to be. I know I'm putting you on the spot.
Oh, you know I will. Like I said, I love you doing your show, and I consider it a great opportunity. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, we always very much appreciate having you as a guest. So much information. Boy, it's very useful. And again, I want to thank the researchers in the room for those excellent questions as well. And Preston, as I sign off tonight, I'd like to just note again to our listening audience how much we appreciate your time. Any questions or comments, feel free to email the show at globalfocusshow@aol.com. And you can reference just the webpage at globalfocus.com for guest details, program details as well. Preston, thank you again. What a pleasure. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a great weekend. Thanks, everyone, for joining us this evening on A Global Focus with guest Preston Dennett. Great weekend.
Hi, I'm Second Medium Chris George.
And I'm Stephanie Benetti. Second Medium, are you sure about that, Chris? It's more like Psychic Extra Large.
Yeah, real funny, Benetti. Depending on being my girlfriend, you would know. Together, we are Second Sight NYC, a parapsychic radio show based out of New York City.
Join us each week as we journey into the unknown. Let's cross the threshold of reality together.
We take a fun and no-nonsense approach to our show, and we love to interact with our audience. Each week, you can expect a great guest, interesting topics, and strong opinions by myself and Stephanie.
As well as rapid readings, psychic dream interpretations, and the gemstone of the week. And don't ask us a question that you don't want an answer to.
Give us 2 hours of your time to inform, enlighten, and entertain you. Let the journey begin.
Join us.
It's not enough to say the word.